hello and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel. Thank you for joining me on Final Draft. It is books, writing, and literary culture. And look, thank you especially if you are joining in. This is a day that I know a lot of people will be relaxing, probably enjoying a food coma. Congratulations on waking up. Again, I know a lot of people probably had a big day yesterday. A lot of you may not have. Some people may have been working. I hope we're all joining together. I hope we're all sharing a love of books. If you received some amazing books recently, that's absolutely brilliant. I love this period for a chance to read and kind of think about the year. I want to start by acknowledging 2SER broadcast from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Now, I am recording from my home. I am on the lands of the Darug and the Gundungurra people. I want to pay my respects to the traditional owners. I want to pay my respects to their ongoing connection to that land and acknowledge it is stolen land. Treaty was never reached in Australia. Now, as I said, this is our last show for the year. The next time I broadcast something new for you, it's going to be 2021. And I know a lot of us have been looking forward to that. 'Cause 2020. I feel like we're going to be studying that. We're going to be punning and memeing on that for a long time. And maybe, like me, you've sought some solace in reading. Maybe you've turned to reading to help you get a little bit of perspective. Maybe, like me, you've also struggled to read this year, and that's completely okay. If I've learned anything in the last week, it's that it's been a hard year for reading, which is no reflection on the books that have come out this year. This year, we have been blessed with some incredible Australian releases, but also, you know, being in a tough situation, being in a situation where your livelihood, the everyday that you've grown to rely on has been challenged, has made looking at challenging reading. I'm currently being joined by my cat Rocket. I'm going to shout out to Rocket because Rocket has also featured heavily this year, appearing on Zoom calls and meowing into the microphone. So shout out to Rocket. And I was saying, if you have been challenged in your reading this year, that's also completely okay, because reading should be about the way we're feeling. Reading is going to guide the way we're feeling, but reading is also going to be guided by the way we're feeling. Today on the show, I want to share and congratulate and celebrate an incredible Sydney artist. And I want to also note an incredible Western Sydney artist, because that is an area, that is a part of Sydney that so often, I mean, it kind of gets bypassed in people's thinking. But Omar Saker is an incredible, proud Western Sydney artist. He is a poet, he is a writer. And a couple of weeks ago, he took out the Poetry Prize in the Prime Minister's Literary Awards. I normally wouldn't give too much thought to anything that has the Prime Minister attached to it, but this is one of the richest prizes for literature in Australia. And Omar is an incredibly well-deserving winner. And his book, his collection, The Lost Arabs, it was described by the judges as vital, energy-driven, with a clear and fearless voice, passionate and sometimes angry, but always lucid and warmly human. Omar and I, last year, about a year and a half ago, we got to have an amazing conversation. He came into the studio back when we could do that sort of thing, and I absolutely loved his generosity in sharing that time with me, and I wanted to share this conversation with you, because so often when we do these conversations, it's when a book has just come out, and I know once upon a time I wasn't buying books when they just came out. It often took me some time to discover them. And if it has taken you some time to discover any of these incredible books, I would encourage you to go out and discover The Lost Arabs. And that's why I'm sharing this conversation. I am going on a little bit. It is my last show of the year, and I think it's my prerogative. But without further ado, I'm going to take a wee break, and then I'm going to come back and share Omar Saker's The Lost Arabs. You are on Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. Join me after this short break.
2SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. And I'm joined in the studio by Omar Saker. Omar is an Arab-Australian poet from Western Sydney. His first collection of poetry, These Wild Houses, was shortlisted for the Judith Wright Award and the Kenneth Slessor Prize for Poetry. He's been published widely in journals and anthologies, and he's here today with a new collection, The Lost Arabs. Omar, welcome to 2SER.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming in, because I found this a beautiful collection, but I was also struck by the fact that I'm reading from my own particular position as a white, cisgendered, straight male. Living in Sydney, I live in Australia, you know, I'm part of a settler society on essentially stolen land. Now, my perspective in some ways may mirror yours, but is also in other ways miles from your experience. And I wondered, as you write, what does readership mean to you, if it means anything?
Yeah, that's a great question. Obviously, everyone reads from their own particular subjectivities. And I am similar in the sense that, you know, I am an Arab Muslim bisexual, also living on stolen land. And it's important that we acknowledge the kind of colonial monstrosity that we're living in and the damage it's doing to various bodies, in particular indigenous bodies, but also refugees and also new migrants. And in particular, in my case, you know, on Arabs and Muslims. So the idea of readership is very important, right? I think there's a focus on writers. I think there's a focus on writing, you know, who's allowed to write what, for example. But not enough focus on reading, because I think it's one of the most extraordinarily intimate things you can do is to read. Because what you're doing when you're reading is you're allowing another voice to enter your mind. That most personal space, you're allowing another voice to enter your mind, you're allowing another history to enter your mind. And there's no defense against that once you are allowing someone in. But I think that's why there's so much pushback so often from white writers who are like, well, we're allowed to write whatever we want. You know what I mean? We're allowed to, where we can, you know, it's an act of empathy. No. It's an act of ego. An act of empathy would be to actually read the work of indigenous writers, of Arab writers, of Muslim writers, to allow our voices uncensored to enter your mind, our histories, our pain, our joys, our loves, you know, our fantasies and our nightmares, because we already have lived and experienced, you know, the manifold white versions of that. So it's important to me for sure that I'm read and that I'm read well. And in particular, you know, I write foremost for queer Arabs, you know, queer people of color, Muslims. I hope always to be able to pay back the debt that I owe to the writers who helped save my life, who helped me get through the hardships that I've faced. I feel a debt. And so I write in the hopes that the people who need it most will find my voice the way that I found other voices.
So the flip side of that then is how voices are asked for or even demanded. And the burden perhaps that is put on people to perform, to explain, to be a certain way. And I was struck by the opening of your poem, Meaning. And if I can, I'm tired of summoning my heritage out of a battered magician's hat. And through Meaning, you explore places of welcoming and exile, and you plead, do not draw fixed lines around my origin. So I wondered then about how the performance of your poetry, how does that intersect with your identity and the reader's calling forth a version of you?
Yeah. So I have a complicated background. My father was Turkish. He was born in Turkey. My mother is Lebanese. She was born in Lebanon, and I was born here. But I was raised with my Lebanese family only. So, you know, I'm aware that I have multiple heritages. I'm also bisexual. So I'm aware always that for some people I'm too Arab, you know, or I'm too Turkish, or amongst those communities I'm too Australian, or, you know, too Muslim to the wider Australian community, or not Muslim enough, or not Arab enough, or not Turkish enough, or not male enough, or too male, or do you know what I mean? Like, I have a number of communities to which I belong, and but that's not the entirety of me, and I'm aware always of how those identities are received. And there are strategies that you can employ, I think, around that. But for me, it's sort of like I wanted in this book to explore multiple versions of myself. Not, there's no one true, authentic self. There are multiple versions of me that have played out in different communities and in different poems. So I just wanted to kind of give voice to them.
It sounds like naming, or perhaps even the privilege of not having to be named, plays a big role. And I was struck then by you talking about different identities and how in different spaces you can be more than or not enough of one. And in the poem Self-Portrait of What Graces the Night, the line, so, "The moon does not identify as moon." So it has this privilege of not having to name because nobody has tried to crush it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's that's really perceptive. I do think that we have been named in an attempt to limit us. And the naming, the original kind of act of naming in this in Western societies was derogatory. It was negative. We were supposed to be ashamed of it. Of our histories and of where we come from, and we're seen as backward and uncultured and all of these things. So there is definitely a power in reclaiming that name and saying, I'm going to use it, in fact, as a way to survive. Mm. And I think that's something that's been going on for, sadly, you know, generations of migrant writers, of like the undesired or unacceptable, the writers from the margins, who have been doing this kind of work. And I think, you know, with all this stuff about identity politics today, I think it's a reaction to the fact that we're taking pride in it now, because we were never meant to. We were never meant to find common ground. We were never meant to be like in solidarity with each other. We were never meant to be like, yeah, I'm Arab and I'm proud. You know, there's a long history of Arab being said as a dirty word. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I've lived through. I've heard people say it like it's the most disgusting thing they've ever encountered. And there's, you know, if you know the work of Jack G. Shaheen, who, you know, spent his life documenting Hollywood movies and TV shows that depicted Arabs, you know, thousands of movies over 100 years showing Arabs in as caricatures, as untrustworthy, as savages. It's really extraordinary how relentless that imagining is of us. And we have to be equally relentless in saying, no, you do not get to define us. You know, we have to do the complicated and messy defining of ourselves. And there's no real right way to do it. You know, I'm not interested in saying, I am this one thing, or this one thing that I am is perfect, is valuable, is moral, or any of that. You know what I mean? It's messy, it's complicated, it's human.
It seems like we're seeing this almost completely unironic pushback from sectors of the white population where words like white supremacist are being railed at by the very people who would use derogatory term, the derogatory terminology that you're talking about. Even the word white is pushed back against by some people who have never been used to hearing themselves called a name or given a label.
Yeah, it's fascinating in a kind of horrifying way, because we had the White Australia policy not long ago. Mm. You know what I mean? It only ended in the 70s.
Like, yeah, that's not a bad name. That's just a fact of history.
Mm. They're not subtle about it. They're not subtle about the foundations of this, you know, colonial nation. They were very adamant about whiteness being the core, the ideal. They were very adamant about it, very public about it, and you know what? They still are. Mm. So it's ludicrous when people say, "Oh, I'm not white." You know what I mean? Like, or I don't benefit from the various privileges that come from it. But in the distress of some people who do react that way, I think it's telling. Yeah. It's telling that even hearing themselves called something against their inclination is enough to produce a kind of panic. While maintaining all their power and privileges, it was still enough to maintain a panic, right? To instigate a panic. So it's like, imagine if you actually didn't have those privileges. Imagine if you actually had to deal with structural racism, if your opportunities were limited because of that whiteness. I think what we would be seeing would be much darker and much more violent, and it's actually kind of where we're heading. If you look at what's been happening, if you look at, even in America, if you look at the kind of the riots in Charleston, the white man with the torches and the whatnot, and the various shooters who have been attacking places of worship, and other places in America and abroad, most recently, of course, in Christchurch. And it's like, I don't know that people who are saying don't call me white or who are trying to shut down the conversation, I don't know if they're fully conscious of the end of the spectrum that they're on. And where the conversation and the various policies that our government implements, where it's heading.
One of the aspects of privilege that we just talked about there are the ways that particularly dominant cultures can interact or choose not to interact with violence. And I was struck by the contrast of the really visceral images of violence, of wars, that you remind us in the collection that as a dominant culture we can allow ourselves to ignore, and the daily lives that in themselves contain another type of violence that we can perpetuate on ourselves, that we can perpetuate on others. And it was in the progression of the four poems, How to Destroy the Body Slowly, that you seem to be showing me, or this is how what I felt, the violence of living every day for 100 years, if you're so lucky, but never to waste a single day on a rose. And the rose I saw was contrast with divinity and faith, an old bear in the chamber of your heart, best left sleeping. Can you tell me about that violence of everyday living?
Yeah, look, it's very much a kind of normalized part of our lives today that we might be on, and it's absolutely a part of our privilege in the West, that we will see on social media or on the news extraordinary violence. Extraordinary violence is being done to people overseas, particularly in the Middle Eastern and North African regions, and it's like almost routine. I wanted to speak about the images of suffering and pain that we're consuming, and then we don't have time to reckon with what that actually means and our own complicity in what's going on, because the next day there's another image, or you know, it's kind of it's unremarked on in the sense that the impact of it is lost in jargon or is statistics in this kind of depersonal language. It's impersonal language. Yeah, so I honestly believe that it is destroying us. I don't believe that you can. It's a kind of amazing and horrifying arrogance to think that you can inflict violence on the other side of the world and that violence won't impact you. Mm. Of course it is. Of course it's impacting us. Any kind of these kinds of injustices, I think, are rotting away at our psyches, our minds. To say nothing of the impact it's having on the victims in these countries, and the countries themselves. And so, yeah, I wanted to say something about it. I wanted to be like, it's part of our responsibility to actually look, to actually listen, to at the very, very least see what is happening. Mm. And so many people are refusing to do even that.
In the poem, you invoke this idea of living 100 years if you should be so lucky. Now, a person who perhaps today had lived 100 years would have a sense of the scope and perhaps even the context of how the cycle of violence began or was at least perpetuated and would maybe have a greater sense of our complicity as an ally to the United States and the way that certain colonial ideas are continually propped up through wars that don't seem to have any particular direct linkage. Do you think we've lost the ability to have that sort of perspective?
I don't think we've lost the ability. I just think it's rarer. And when we see, you know, government cuts to the arts, when we see newspapers and the changes they've made to the way they report because of funding shortages, you know, we see where the value is being put in terms of our public discourses, and it is toward a more immediate, more reactive kind of cycle of information. And I think, yeah, absolutely, that's really damaging. I think, and not just in the arts or not just in media, but also our education, which is, you know, wildly unequal. We have all these private schools which are overfunded, which have an excess to the tune of millions of dollars, while there are public schools. You know, I went to a public school. I went to a disadvantaged public school, Liverpool Boys High, where there are schools that are really struggling to have the resources to teach kids the things that they need to know and the critical thinking, especially, that they need to be able to look at what's being said and understand it on a level beyond the kind of surface propaganda or the surface desired response that it's trying to instill in you as a reader.
A key to that process, I feel like, is awareness, but it's also memory. It's that ability to think beyond the moment. And some lines that I just pulled out and was trying to make sense of from your poem, Instead Memory, which is, I've pulled out a very small part of that poem, but it's I am obliged to love what I cannot erase. My memories ache for this to be true. They do not want to die. Even my darkest knowing seeks the light. And for me, this was an aching, sort of almost an aching confession that could be writ large, but it is also very personal. I wondered, though, how you go about reconciling self and memory, how you work through those, or if
I don't.
Perhaps that's a constantly recursive process rather than a linear.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, it's certainly something that I circle around, you know, the various kind of traumas in my life that part of me really wishes I could get rid of, but have also made me who I am.
We live in a world where we're not really allowed to do that, though, are we? We're supposed to, I mean, particularly we're in the middle of a political campaign where... it feels like everyone has to be their best self and their any other self must be hidden. Whether on the left, that is hiding the extreme left views that you have, and on the right, it's the extreme right views. Is that sort of, have we lost room for those, the darkest knowings that you describe?
I hope not. I think what we see a lot are false certainties, right? We see certainties pushed from every angle. And what I'm, as someone who has suffered various traumas in my life, you know, uncertainty is my guiding principle. So it kind of, it leaves me in a unsettled place, which is not great for my mental health, my anxiety. But, you know, it's also a really generative position. And I think we need to express all of these things. I don't think it's good to just repress or pretend.
Omar Seker is the author of The Lost Arabs. It is a collection of poems that is out now. I cannot encourage you, dear listener, more to check it out. Omar, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
Thank you for joining me. Thank you for tuning in. You are on 2SER 107.3, and this is Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel. It is books, writing, and literary culture, and all year we have been talking books, writing, and literary culture in a year that has been extraordinarily difficult. I am joined by my cat, Rocket, who is circling the microphone and butting her fuzzy little self up against the microphone. She probably will not join us. But I've got to say, in a year that has been extraordinarily difficult for everyone, Rocket has been a ray of light, joining me on Zoom calls, sitting in front of the computer and nuzzling up to the microphone. So again, I'm going to shout out to her as she lies on my keyboard, and I really hope she doesn't mess up my final recording as I say goodbye to you for the year. Today, I shared a conversation with Omar Seker. This conversation was actually recorded in 2019, but only a few weeks ago, Omar won the 2020 Prime Minister's Literary Award for poetry. He is an extraordinarily deserving poet. I think 2020 is a year that has asked so much of us, and perhaps not given us, we've had a lot of time. It's felt like we've had a lot of time to think, but maybe this is a time to stop again and think back on our year. I hope literature has given you that. I hope the opportunity to read and reflect on poems, on essays, on novels has given you space that has allowed you to move away from your day-to-day and give you some reflection. If it hasn't been like that for you, I mean, I hope that's something that you can look forward to. And if, like me, like so many other people, I've heard incredible readers, we love our reading, but this has been a hard year sometimes to read. And I discovered that in the last few weeks when I picked up a few books that are just old friends, and I rediscovered what it meant to just read easily, for words to slip past me and for me to turn page after page because I found comfort in them. And sometimes being challenged with new ideas this year has felt difficult. If it has felt difficult to you, know that you're not alone. Know that the reading is still so very important and there are so many incredible books to discover. I'm going to have to say goodbye. I know it's almost time for my show to end. I am looking forward to bringing you more Final Draft in 2021. I am going to take a break though. I will keep bringing you some favorite conversations. I wish you a happy new year wherever this finds you. I'm in Sydney and it has looked so incredibly uncertain over the last week or two. And I mean, I hope that we can look forward and I hope that there is something more hopeful in 2021, but I know that we have books. Happy New Year, everyone. I wish you the best and I look forward to joining you. And as always, in the interceding time, happy reading. Bye now.